Welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's Story Podcast Series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. In 2005, Rhys Bowen wrote a haunting story for us called The Wall. It is beautifully written and wonderfully structured with emotional oscillations that build to a terrifying climax. We've included her story in our newest electronic anthology called Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine Presents 13 Tales of New American Gothic. Here's Rhys Bowen reading her story, The Wall, followed by a brief Q&A.
No man has entered these walls for more than a quarter century. The Mother Superior's face, surrounded by its starch white wimple, was ageless and expressionless, and appeared to have been chiseled from white marble. Not even a priest, not even a doctor, she added. Her clear blue eyes seemed innocent enough as they looked directly at the young man, but he had the uncanny feeling that she was reading his thoughts. He had, in fact, just been thinking that priests and doctors must surely have been admitted to the convent in a quarter century. The priest comes only to our chapel, which is, of course, outside the walls. And on rare occasions when a doctor has been needed, our sick sisters are carried to the parlour, which is also on the other side. Thus, we have remained apart and inviolate, in accordance with our foundress's command. We are, as you know, one of the stricter orders. I don't know very much, the young man said, only what I've heard in the village. And what do they say in the village? That nobody who goes to the convent ever returns. He grinned. That is true enough. The Reverend Mother nodded slightly. Not one sister who has made her vows here has ever chosen to leave us. Not one in 150 years. An admirable record, wouldn't you say? She obviously didn't expect an answer, but went on. We pride ourselves on our self-sufficiently. We grow almost all our own food. We spin our own wool, weave our own cloth. We make our own medicines. Only once in a while do we come upon a task that cannot be performed by one of our sisters. You have been summoned for such a task, Monsieur Clément. Sister Perpetua is as good a handyman as you will find, but she has no experience with bricks and mortar. What exactly is it you wanted doing, Reverend Mother? Jacques Clément asked, fiddling with the cap he clutched in his hands. There wasn't much that made him nervous, but the Reverend Mother's steely gaze fixed on his face was pretty unnerving. Come with me, she said. I will show you. She held open a grillwork door for him to pass through. It clanged shut behind him. Then she set off at a great pace down a flagstone corridor, the flapping of her sandals echoing back from the stone walls. We have an unused chapel in the wing that once housed our infirmary. That whole wing is now in disrepair, and we lack the funds to renovate it. Actually, it's no longer needed, since our numbers are not what they were. But recently, one of our sisters was struck by falling masonry as she attempted to sweep the chapel floor. I can't risk that happening again, and have decided the only solution is to have it bricked up. I understand that you know how to work with bricks. She turned back to address him. I've done a bit of masonry, yes, but I'm really only a handyman. If you want anything fancy, nothing fancy will be required, and we have no money to pay for a master mason. You come highly recommended from the village, and I'm sure you'll prove quite satisfactory. Your father was a jack of all trades before you, I understand. Did he teach you well? She glanced up again. The young man smiled grimly. Hardly a chance for that. He walked out on us when I was a little kid. Got fed up with village life and wanted excitement, I expect. It is pretty quiet in these parts, and my father had been a sailor and sailed around the world when he was young. Really? The Reverend Mother sniffed. I understand that sailors are known to be unreliable. So you have now taken over the reins of the business, have you? My dad left most of his old tools behind, and there was no other handyman, and I seem to have inherited the knack. Have you also inherited the knack for wandering off? Reverend Mother was gazing at him again, making him wish he'd never accepted this job. I'm not intending to stay in Saint-Cyr all my life, if that's what you mean, and I wouldn't mind seeing a bit of the world. Would you be deserting those who rely on your support, as your father did? He smiled. I'm still fancy-free, Reverend Mother. no woman has managed to tie me down yet. And your poor mother, do you support her? She died a couple of years ago, caught pneumonia. She never was very strong. The nun shot him another sharp glance, then opened a door at the end of the cloister. This way, please. And before we enter, I must warn you that you're not to speak to the sisters, or even look at them if they pass you in the corridors. We have chosen to shut ourselves away from men, and the sight of you may put temptation into the hearts of our younger sisters. She set off at a great pace again, up a flight of steps and along a narrow hallway. A mere slit of window to his left, like an arrow slot in a castle battlement, revealed the landscape below, the neat patchwork of fields stretching down to the St. Lawrence River, and the blue hills rising beyond it in the distance. A string of barges was making its way upstream. He could make out smoke rising from the chimneys in Saint-Cyr. "A nice view you've got here," he said, more to break the oppressing silence than anything else. "This is the only window within our walls with any kind of view on the outside world," she said. "Our sisters come here to shut themselves off from the world, not to be reminded of it." "Enough idle chatter. Hurry up." He wondered what the rush was to brick up a disused chapel, then decided that she wanted him out of the hallways before he encountered another nun. There was complete silence in the building. All doors that he passed were closed. More steps, more hallways. At last, Reverend Mother stopped and indicated a door to her left. "In here." There was no light in the chapel, and its vaulted roof was lost in gloom. It smelled damp and musty. Ferns had sprouted through the cracks in the masonry. This part of the building actually goes into the hillside, which made it a very unfortunate setting for an infirmary, as you can imagine. It was only after several sisters were lost to complications of influenza that the infirmary was moved to the front of the building, where the healthful breezes blow up from the river. Jacques Clément thought of autumn squalls and Arctic gales and decided that the new infirmary situation might be as bad as the last. But he didn't say this to Reverend Mother. "You'll want me to get surprise," he said. "Take measurements today and then order bricks and mortar." "Everything you need is already here," she said, "except for tools that no doubt you have with you. You came in a vehicle." "My pickup truck is parked outside. My tools are in it." "Excellent. Couldn't be better." For the first time she expressed a nod of approval, and Jacques felt pleasure flush through him like a student who has finally won over a strict teacher. "You will drive your truck in through the gates and park in the building to your right, which was once a cowshed, when we possessed our own dairy herd. In it you will find the bricks and sacks of mortar, as well as a wheelbarrow to transport them. You will go straight across the courtyard and in through the green door at the back. That way you will have no need to disturb the daily routine of any of our sisters." She waited for him to nod in assent. "Do you think you will be able to finish in one day?" Jacques Clément inspected the archway. "I doubt it," he said. "It will be heavy work transporting all those bricks across to start with. In which case you will stay overnight. I'll have a room prepared for you in this wing, and your food will be brought to you. I'd rather go home, if you don't mind. It's only half an hour's drive. And I'd rather that you didn't disturb the rhythm of our tranquillity by driving your truck in and out of our enclosure. You will be quite comfortable. We do not put our guests through the rigours of our own chosen lifestyle." He opened his mouth to protest, and then thought better of it and gave a submissive bow. High in a tower, a bell tolled. The Reverend Mother looked up. "The second office of the day. I will escort you back to the gate, where you will find your truck. Come." She spoke the word as one would to a dog, and he trotted obediently at her heels. Along unseen hallways he heard the slap and swish of sandals and robes as nuns made their way to the chapel. It felt like being in a community of ghosts. He found the gate, the courtyard, and the cowshed as directed. The shed already contained rusting farm machinery and old trucks, half hidden under tarpaulins. Why hadn't they sold them when they were no longer used, he wondered. Surely convents always needed money. Then he loaded bricks into the barrow and had no more energy for thought. Bricks in the barrow, out across the courtyard, in through green door and down the deserted hall. He repeated the process over and over until he was clammy with sweat and starving hungry. He wished he'd been smart enough to bring his lunch with him, but he hadn't expected to have to start work immediately. Did nuns eat at lunchtime? And more to the point, would they remember him? As if on cue,
He heard the light tap of feet coming down the hall, and looked up to see a young girl in a short black habit and veil coming towards him. She was bearing a tray on which there was a large bowl of soup, a hunk of dark bread, as well as cheese, tomatoes, and green onions. Beside it was a pitcher of water and a glass. "Your lunch, monsieur." The girl's eyes were cast down as she held out the tray. "Where would you like me to put it?" He scrambled to his feet. "Here, I'll take it." Their hands brushed as he took the tray from her, and he saw her blush. Then he realized with surprise that he recognized her. "It's Marie, isn't it? You live on a farm, out Saint-Denis way?" "Used to live." She glanced up just long enough to make eye contact and gave him a gentle half-smile. "I live here now." "Of course, silly of me. But we met before. I came out to work on your grandfather's barn, and there was some kind of church festival going on, and you were serving some kind of food. Donuts," she said, smiling more broadly now. "You ate several, I remember." He held out his hand. "I'm Jacques Clément." "We are not allowed to shake hands, monsieur." "I'm sorry, obviously not. If merely looking at a man can drive you to temptation. And if they want you to avoid temptation at all costs, how come they choose the prettiest and youngest nun to bring me my meal? Is this some kind of test?" She laughed then. "Oh, no, monsieur. I was sent with your tray because I work in the kitchen, and because I am merely a postulant. I haven't yet made my vows." "So that explained the less severe habit. How long before you do that?" "When the novice mistress thinks I'm ready." She made a face. "I have too much spirit and stubbornness, I'm afraid. Taking orders from everybody does not come easily to me." "Me neither," he said. "That's why I've always been my own boss." "You are lucky to have skills that enable you to be free like that." She looked down at her hands. "I would otherwise have ended up as a wife, taking orders from my husband." "Not all men boss their wives around." "All the men I know do." "Is that why you came here? To escape from being bossed around by men?"
"I did not come here to escape, monsieur," she said frostily. "Please leave your empty tray at the end of the hall. I'll be back to collect it when I have time." Then she walked away. He wanted to call after her, but restrained himself. It was none of his business if she wanted to shut herself away in this place. Perhaps she really had received a calling from God, and who was he to dispute the Almighty? But he couldn't help feeling it was a waste of those large dark eyes. He finished the food and got back to work. But he had scarcely begun when he looked up to see a shadow falling over him. "I forgot to mention one small matter," Mother Superior said, making him believe that she'd been eavesdropping on his conversation with Marie. "I would like you to leave a small opening at the base of your wall."
"How small?"
"Big enough to crawl through, just in case we ever needed to access the chapel again. You can do that, can't you? I mean, the wall will stand with a small hole at its base." "No problem," he said. "Your lunch was satisfactory."
"Excellent, thank you."
"We do not believe in starving the body. A healthy body is essential for hard work, and everyone in this convent is expected to work hard. I began as dairy maid, milking the cows each day at 5 o'clock in the morning. In winter time, my hands were covered in chilblains. I came here as a pampered daughter. I can tell you it was something of a shock, but I survived."
"How long have you been here, Reverend Mother?" he asked.
35 years. I entered as a very young woman."
"But you're not from around here, are you? Your accent sounds superior to us French Canadians, as if you came from France."
"I did indeed come from France, from the port city of Bordeaux."
"What made you come over here?"
"This convent." "You chose this particular convent out of all the nunneries in the world?"
"Why?"
"Because I wanted to get away from France, and because it suited my needs. I have never regretted my decision to come here." He found himself wondering if every nun actually was running away from something rather than running to a convent. Again, as if she could read his thoughts, she said sharply, "No, I was not running away. There was nothing unpleasant about my life at home, but nothing worth staying for either. But I mustn't keep you from your work, since you're charging us by the hour." Then she was gone with a rustle of skirts and slap of sandals. Jacques worked on. Daylight failed, and he could find no electricity in the hallway. When it became too dark to see, he stood at the end of the hall, wondering what to do next. He could hardly go and find them without incurring Mother Superior's wrath. Again, as if on cue, he heard the tap of light feet coming towards him, and Marie appeared with another tray.
"I couldn't find the light," he said.
"There is none in this part of the building. They used to use candles. We still have candles in our cells, but there's electric light in the main rooms of the new wing. You'll have to put up with a candle tonight, I'm afraid. It's down here." She led him back along the hallway and pushed open a door on her right. She put down the tray on a table by the door and swiftly lit the candle for him.
"Enjoy your dinner, monsieur," she said.
The candle light made her face look hollow. "You wouldn't like to stay and keep me company," he asked. "It's really dark and lonely in here."
"I'm expected back in the kitchen to serve my sisters, monsieur." She gave a little bow. "If I were you, I'd go to sleep right after you've eaten, so that you can be up at first light and get your job finished. If you put your tray outside the door, one of us will collect it." She turned to go. "Marie."
He grabbed her wrist. She gave a little gasp, went to struggle free, then stared down at his big red workman's hand around her small white one.
"Don't do it," he whispered. "Don't shut yourself away from life. There's a wonderful world out there. You should be dancing and letting some fellow kiss you in the moonlight. God made us to live our lives, not to bury ourselves prematurely."
"And where would I find this fellow who would take me dancing and kiss me in the moonlight?" she asked, looking up with a little smile on her lips.
"I wouldn't mind volunteering for the job myself," he smiled back.
"Mother warned us of temptation. Perhaps you were right. That is why she assigned this duty to me after all, my big test. I must go. I'll be missed. I have to answer to the novice mistress and to Mother." He looked around the bleak little room.
"I wish I could understand the appeal of this place. I mean, what is there in it for you? Locked away with a bunch of dried-up old women? Your reverent mother came halfway around the world to be here. There must be something."
The smile this time was slightly wicked. "They say that Mother came here after she was betrayed by a young man in France. It may be just gossip, but Mother is certainly distrustful of all men."
"She may have reason," Jack said, and his gaze held hers. "We sometimes get carried away by a pretty face or a neat little figure." She jerked her hand away from him.
"I really must." She turned and ran.
Jacques heard her light feet echoing back along the cloister. Then he sat on the hard wooden chair and ate the meal. A thick vegetable soup, more coarse bread, some stewed fruit and a cookie. A glass of milk accompanied it this time. He drank it, longing for beer, and put his tray outside the door. He hesitated as he did so, staring down the long dark hallway and wondering if she would be back for it and would tap on his door if he forgot to put the tray outside. "You'll burn in hell for trying to seduce a nun," he told himself firmly, then reminded himself that she wasn't a nun yet. There was still time. He had flirted with her that day at her grandfather's farm, but hadn't shown enough interest to make a second date with her, or even to drive out that way again. It must be the old saying about forbidden fruit tasting sweeter. Now that she was in that nun's uniform, he couldn't wait to rip it off her. At last he fell into uneasy sleep, and woke to the crowing of a rooster and the first grey streaks of light in the eastern sky. He washed at the sink down the hall and was busy at work when the breakfast tray arrived.
"Your breakfast, monsieur."
He looked at the round, expressionless face of a round, middle-aged nun. "Where's Marie?"
"Marie?
The girl who brought my meals yesterday."
"I don't know, sir. I was instructed by Mother to bring your breakfast, and one always obeys Mother's orders. Bon appétit, monsieur."
He sat, resting his back against the new wall, to eat the bowl of oatmeal, the boiled egg and toast, then went back to work. The wall would be finished by lunchtime if he worked hard. It took him longer than he anticipated, setting the final bricks into the curve of the archway, and a lunch tray was brought by the same round-faced sister. He went straight back to work and finished by mid-afternoon. Mother Superior arrived again as if on cue, as he was gathering his tools and loading the leftover bricks into the wheelbarrow.
"Leave that, monsieur. One of our sisters can attend to the cleaning up."
"But the bricks are heavy. Wouldn't you like me to wheel them back to the cowshed for you?"
"Our sisters are used to hard labor, monsieur. Just leave everything as you see it. You have done splendidly, a good solid wall. Come along now."
She waved him along the hall with her hand, like someone directing a flock of ducks. He picked up his tool bag and fell into step beside her.
"I was wondering, what happened to the young girl who brought my food yesterday?" he said. "I used to know her before she came here. I hope she didn't get into trouble for chatting with me. She was the soul of virtue, by the way."
"To your regret, monsieur?"
To his annoyance, he blushed. It seemed a shame for someone as young and pretty as that to shut herself away before she had a chance to experience life outside.
"And what should she have experienced, monsieur? Should she have waited to discover heartbreak and betrayal? Should she discover that all men are, as you put it, fancy-free?"
"Not all men, mother."
"No?
Did you not tell me yourself that you planned to see the world? If Marie were available to you, would you be prepared to give up that dream?"
"She's not available, is she?
I hope she sets her sights higher than a mere laborer such as yourself, monsieur."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that Marie left the convent this morning. She came to me and told me that she no longer felt she had the temperament to become a sister here. She's gone, monsieur."
"Gone? Home? Back to Saint-Denis?"
"That I can't tell you. His heart soared momentarily. He'd find her, and...
Then he paused.
Did he really want her? At least it would be fun to find out. They crossed the courtyard and reached the pickup truck in the cowshed. I will make sure that the gate is left open for you, monsieur, and take my leave of you here. You will be sending me your bill.
Yes, mother.
Goodbye, then, Monsieur Clément.
Goodbye, ma mère.
She was gone. He threw his bag into the back of the pickup truck. He was out of here, back to normal life. He'd find Marie easily enough. Why did Mother Superior think he wouldn't? Then the nagging uneasiness exploded in his head. Mother Superior had told him that nobody left the order in 150 years. Why had she let Marie go so easily? And why had she decided to brick up that old chapel now? And why had she insisted that he left the extra big bricks there? There was only one answer, one that sent his heart thumping. Marie was to be bricked up behind that wall. Maybe she was lying drugged at this moment. Maybe she was already dead. Either way, she would just disappear, and nobody would ever question her disappearance. Or not if he could help it. He ran back across the courtyard. The green door was now locked. He started to run around the courtyard, trying one door after another. At last he found a window open and climbed through, squeezing his hefty body through it with difficulty. He had no idea where he was, but sprinted down a hallway, his feet echoing alarmingly from the stone walls and slate floor. Another hallway, then another. He encountered no one, and at last he thought he recognized the room where he'd spent the night. Just down the hall and around the corner, and the wall was there, a pile of bricks beside it, untouched. He stood staring at it, his heart thumping, and the cold sweat of panic trickling down his face. What should he do next? Think, Clément, think. He pounded one fist into another. He couldn't actually go and accuse Mother Superior. She'd never let him search the convent. And if he drove down to the village and alerted the police, they'd probably laugh at him. There was only one thing to do. He'd lie in wait and catch her in the act, or them in the act. It would take more than one of them to carry Marie all this way and shove her through the small opening. He looked around for somewhere to hide. The doors on either side were locked. He stood there, undecided, trying to make his brain think logically. Then he stiffened. It was the slightest of sounds, a mere whispering rustle, but it echoed within the vaulted walls of the chapel. She was in there already, and she wasn't dead yet. In a flash, he was down on his stomach, attempting to squeeze his muscular body through the little opening. He wriggled through, his elbows scraping on the stone floor, and stood uncertainly on the other side. It was very dark. That small square of light from the opening was rapidly swallowed into the gloom, so that the back of the chapel melted into blackness. His hand touched the wall for reassurance, and then he began to move along the left-hand wall, his hand tracing the pillars and recesses for niches. It was cold and clammy to the touch.
Marie? He dared to whisper. Marie, are you in here?
As his eyes accustomed themselves to the darkness, he tried to see if anyone was on the floor. He came upon the altar rail, but the black lump beside it proved only to be an ancient kneeler. It was impossible. He should go back for a flashlight. Then he heard the noise again, the slightest swish of moving fabric. As he turned to it, he was hit from behind, and blackness overcame him. He came to gradually, like a diver surfacing from deep water. His head throbbed, and he felt sick. It took him a while to remember where he was, before the cold reality of the stone beneath his cheek brought him to his knees. He must get out of here. That was when he saw that the square of light from the little hole had shrunk. Before, the opening had been almost 2 feet square. Now it was barely visible. His first reaction was that he'd lain there for a long while and night was falling. Then he made his way to the hint of daylight, crawling on his hands and knees, and his hand encountered solid, cold brick where the opening had been. Solid, except for a couple of bricks at the top. He tried to catch his breath as he pushed against this new wall of brick. It couldn't have been there that long. The mortar would still be wet and he'd be strong enough to...
There is little point in trying to do that, monsieur. The voice on the other side was Mother Superior's. We made the provision of buying some quick-drying mortar. It should have set nicely by now.
He put his face to the opening and peered out. All he could see was the black fabric of her habit.
What in God's name are you doing? He demanded. Are you mad? What have I ever done to you?
You lived, Monsieur Clément, the cold voice said. You lived, and my child died.
What are you talking about? What child?
The child of your father, monsieur. Your father, the sailor who wooed me when his ship docked in Bordeaux. He swore that he loved me, and I, innocent girl that I was, believed him. He sailed away before I discovered that I was with child. I did not wish to bring disgrace to my family, so I followed him to Canada, sure he would do the right thing and marry me when he discovered the truth. Instead, I found that he already had a wife and a baby son of his own. You, monsieur. He denied ever knowing me. The shock was so great that I miscarried. After that, I swore to have nothing more to do with men. I came to this place, but the desire for revenge gnawed at me. Christians are supposed to forgive their enemies. I know. I kept telling myself that, but it wouldn't go away. It was a blackness in my heart that never subsided. And then fate brought me revenge on a platter. Some years later, we needed some work done on our leaking roof, and the handyman summoned was your father. Imagine what I felt when I saw him getting out of his truck. I served his dinner that night. He didn't even recognize me. I put rat poison in his coffee, and afterwards I put him in one of the stone coffins in our crypt. His truck is now rusting with our farm equipment in the cowshed, where your truck also rests, monsieur. But am I to be punished for the sins of my father? He demanded. I did you no wrong. As I said, you lived. You have had a chance to enjoy life, and I saw from my conversations with you and from observing you with Marie that you would turn out no better than your father was. You would woo some poor girl and then desert her as I was deserted. Better that such men be removed from the face of the earth before they can do their damage. No, he shouted. You've got it wrong. I'm a decent guy. Don't do this, I beg you. Don't do it. Let me out. I promise I'll go away from here and say nothing about all this if only you let me out. I promise. For God's sake, you of all people. The sound became muffled as the last brick was put into place.
Thank you, Reese, for your reading of The Wall. The Wall was published in Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine in July-August of 2005. I want to note that you are the author of a series of novels that feature Lady Victoria Georgiana Charlotte Eugenie, cousin of King George V in England, set in the 1930s. And, as it happens, we are recording this podcast the day after the wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton. What are your thoughts about the royal wedding?
Well, I got up at 3 o'clock my time, because I'm from the West Coast, to watch it, and I thought it was absolutely lovely. I contrasted it very much with the wedding of Charles and Diana, which I felt was a stage spectacle. And I thought in this case, this was a wedding, even though there were lots of people there, this was a wedding of two young people who loved each other, giving each other their vows. And I was amazed how serene and calm Kate looked. I mean, everybody's nervous on their wedding day, and she looked as if she was born to it. She looked completely happy. The fact that they'd look at each other and give each other this funny little smile just shows you how very compatible they were. Her dress, I thought, was stunning. I thought the bridesmaid looked stunning, and all those dear little flower girls. I have to say, the princesses, Beatrix and Eugenie, I did not care for their hats very much, or their costumes. I thought fashion had gone too far in that case, but I thought everybody looked very happy, and it was a nice happy day. I thought it was wonderful.
It was exciting to see all the crowds crowds cheering, cheering for their happiness.
Well, the other thing that impressed me was how very well the London police handled the crowds. I mean, when they moved forward to fill up the whole square, there was no pushing, there was no shoving, just the police moved calmly forwards and the crowd moved calmly forward behind them. And there was none of that panic that you get in some places. It was very well handled.
Yes.
I wonder if you could contrast the life of the royals today to that of the time in which your series is set, and perhaps tell us why you chose to set the series in the 1930s.
Well, interestingly enough, I heard the other day when Prince William was interviewed that he liked to make himself baked beans on toast. Well, my heroine, Lady Georgie, that's about the one thing she can cook too, so they have quite a lot in common. But since she's a very minor royal compared with him, she has a lot more freedom than he would have had. But normally the royals in that day lived such a remote life. I mean, even William's grandmother, even the Queen, has never handled money, has never actually been out in public and seen what Marks and Spencers looks like. You know, she's had this rarefied life, and of course Charles had the sort of life in which he was brought up by nannies and was brought to see his mother maybe for 10 minutes a day, and so really doesn't know what a normal family was. William
by contrast, had Diana, who was very hands-on. Mm-hmm. And you see that in him. You see that he's comfortable in normal life. He's comfortable with normal people. He wants to be as normal as possible. The fact that they're moving into a house with no servants, four-bedroom house with no servants, and they're going to live there, is just amazing. When you think of the amount of security that would need in this country, for example, yes. they're going to live in their little house. So I think that until it was... The royalty in the 30s was pretty much the same as the royalty until William. He's the one who's changed it.
Interesting.
Can you tell us about the latest book in the series, Noddy and Niece?
That's coming out actually this September 2011. And this is going to be the fifth book. And Georgie, until now, has been struggling to make her own life. She is part of the royal family, but she's completely penniless. And so it's the Great Depression. How does one manage to survive when one really has no skills except how to walk around with a book on your head, how to curtsy, where to seat a bishop at the dinner table? You know, she has no marketable skills at all. So she's tried various methods, all disastrous, of how to survive. And I thought she needed a little treat for a change. So I did what a lot of the British, the upper-class British, did in those days. I sent her to the Riviera for the winter. She's asked, actually, to go and do a little task for Queen Mary, who sometimes asks her to do little embarrassing things. And she gets to the Riviera, and she finds that various people she knows are there, including her mother. And when I was researching it, I wanted to see who might really have been on the Riviera that summer. And sometimes when you do research, you hit pay dirt. And I found that not only was Coco Chanel there in a villa very close to where Georgie would be staying, but that she put on a fashion show. And for this fashion show, she was combining the masculine and the feminine. So she borrowed tweed jackets from her lover, the Duke of Westminster, and she combined them with lace and frills and things. And she borrowed jewellery from Queen Mary in England. And so when I read that, I thought, this is too good not to include. So Georgie is on the Riviera for the winter. And obviously there's a body or two as well, so I'm not going to tell you who gets killed.
You are currently writing two series of novels at once. Your Molly Murphy books are now in their 10th outing, and the Molly Murphy series is set in a very different world, turn of the century New York. How do you manage that?
Yeah, it's interesting that people have said to me quite a lot, don't you ever get your heroines mixed up? And don't you ever make Georgie do something that Molly would do? And I said, well, how often do you get your children mixed up? You know, the worlds are so different. I think that's why it's very good for me, because Molly's world is a fairly dark, gritty world of immigrant New York. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's had adventures in the sweatshops, and she's met gang members. She's done some fairly unpleasant things, whereas Georgie's world is, on the whole, light and frothy and funny. Mm-hmm. So when I'm writing Georgie, they're supposed to be funny. I sit and chuckle. Uh-huh. And Molly's worlds are fairly dark and intense and involve quite a lot of research. So they're very different from each other. So when I'm writing one, I'm always looking forward to doing the other, and I think that keeps me fresh for both of them.
Molly Murphy is an Irish immigrant to New York City and a natural crime solver. And as you say, she becomes, over the course of the series, a private eye. These books deal with a lot of social issues of the day, the suffragette movement, sweatshops in the garment district. And now, in Bless the Bride, Molly takes on the case involving Chinese immigrants. Can you tell us a little more about this book and talk about where you find topics to tackle in these books?
Well, from the title, you can tell that after 10 books, Molly is finally approaching her own wedding, which she has resisted because she knows that at that time, to be a married woman is really to give up your own freedom, to give up pretty much any rights. At that time, a woman could not own property. She could be beaten with anything thinner than her husband's thumb. That was the rule of thumb. She literally had no say. And so she realizes that giving up her own business and her own freedom, even though her life has been fairly precarious, requires a big decision. And she's finally decided she can make that decision, and she's going to get married. But she accepts one last case because it seems very straightforward. She's summoned to a rich man who apparently has lost an object he wants her to find. And so she goes, and she's rather horrified to find that this rich man is a Chinese merchant in the middle of Chinatown, and the object that he wants her to find is a woman. Mm-hmm. And it's a young bride that he has purchased in China and had shipped over. And so I wrote this book because the whole book deals with the concept of what a bride is in various cultures.
the fact that Molly is coming to this after much decision of her own free will, and that this young girl has been shipped across as an object from China and will be a virtual slave. So Molly's in a very big moral dilemma here. If she finds the young girl, she's returning her to virtual slavery with an old man. But if she doesn't find her, there's nowhere for her to go, because the Chinese live in this little tiny restricted area. They're hated, they're despised. There's no life for her in America at all. So Molly's really in a huge dilemma about what to do. And Molly always wants to make things right. She has this great sense of justice, which isn't always wise. But somehow she wants to save this girl, not realizing the full implications of that if she tries to save her.
Okay, well, we have to read the book.
Yes, please read the book. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much, and thank you for reading The Wall for us.
Well, thank you very much too, Linda.
I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. I'm with Reese Bowen at the 23rd Malice Domestic Convention in Bethesda, Maryland. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a monthly magazine of short crime fiction published by Dell Magazines, a division of Crosstown Publications. You can find the magazine at your newsstand, and digital versions are now available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, FictionWise, Sony, and Zinio. Our new electronic anthology, Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, presents 13 Tales of New American Gothic. It's available at Amazon.com. You can find out more about us online at themysteryplace.com. We also encourage you to visit our Facebook page.